Who is he? Now, I recognize fully that today is actually the second Sunday of Lent, and the gospel lesson I just read for you is actually the lesson from last week, but I wasn't here last week, and I really want to share this passage with you. I looked it up, and I haven't actually preached on Jesus' temptation for a very long time, and yet it's a very important story in the life of Jesus. So I moved it to today's lesson and hope it is as challenging a passage to you as it is for me. To begin with, though, I want to share an experience that maybe many of us in this room can appreciate. There was a man who was overweight, and he decided that he had excess pounds to lose. He was very diligent and stuck to his diet very strictly. He even had a new route to work so he wouldn't drive by his favorite bakery in the morning. However, one day, he came into work with a big coffee cake. And his co-worker started to scorn him and said, "Hey, explain this." He said, "You see, I accidentally drove past my favorite bakery today, and I saw all those delicious coffee cakes in the display case. So I prayed. I prayed to God and said, 'If you really think I should have this delicious coffee cake, then have an open spot right in front of the bakery.' And as soon as I drove around for the eighth time, sure enough, there was a bark spot." Temptations are a part of all of our lives. If you draw breath, you will at some point, actually, probably at many points, be tempted. Every week in this fellowship, we pray the Lord's words and say, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." But it's an ongoing struggle, isn't it? Jesus knew that it was going to be so for us, and I wonder if that's why he put this in the Lord's Prayer, "Lead us not into temptation." It maybe was part of a reflection on his own experience in the wilderness. There needs to be a cautionary note inserted here today, though. Often when we read the temptation story of Jesus' life, our first impulse is to draw comfort from the fact that Jesus experienced the same scourge of humanity that we all do. But hold on a minute. Is that an accurate understanding of the temptation story? Read very carefully what Satan tempts Jesus with. "The things that tempt me are," they're a lot different than the ones that Satan tried to tempt Jesus with. "I've never been tempted to get up on a high building and jump off to test God's care for me. But that extra donut, I'm all over it." Could it be that something more is going on here than what I personally ever face? Philip Yancey, in his wonderful book, The Jesus I Never Knew, suggests that Satan tested Jesus as he did because he wasn't sure who Jesus actually was. At least not at the beginning. Satan was wondering as he tested Jesus, "Who is this man?" The British poet Gerald Manley Hopkins presented the temptation story as a kind of get acquainted session between Satan and Jesus. Satan is pictured in that poem as being completely in the dark about the whole nature of the incarnation. Was Jesus just an ordinary man? Was he an angel with limited powers like himself? Or was he the incarnation of God? His challenges to Jesus in the wilderness were really a way for Jesus to reveal his true nature. And the implications of this are quite eye-opening. Martin Luther speculated that throughout Jesus' life, he conducted himself so humbly and associated with so many sinful people and was, as a consequence, not held in any kind of high regard or esteem. And on account of that, Luther suggests, the devil overlooked him. It is beginning to appear as though the temptation story unmasked Satan, but God's agenda remained hidden. If you are God, said Satan, dazzle me. Act like God should act. And Jesus' reply is that only God makes those decisions, therefore I can do nothing at your command. No matter how weakened by hunger or worn out by that desert heat, Jesus knew who was in charge, and it wasn't Satan, which literally means the word Satan, accuser. Consider also for a moment what Satan offered that was so tempting. Because it was a major improvement to the human condition, what he offered Jesus. Satan attempted Jesus to take a good part of being human and reject all the bad parts. We might say, well, who could blame Jesus for giving in? In other words, Satan wanted Jesus to deny the full impact of the incarnation. He wanted Jesus to wear the crown, but not the cross. Maybe we are honest enough to consider that, well, maybe Jesus should have taken Satan up on his offer. You ever thought that? Maybe life would be so much better knowing that if we got hungry, we could go out in a parking lot and see a rock and it would suddenly turn into bread. Wouldn't it be great that in the midst of a great serious deliberation about what this community should do, a giant billboard appears in the sky letting us know what to do? Could Jesus have not taken a more hands-on approach to being the Messiah? You know, we're not the first people to consider this. I don't know if you're very familiar with what are called the apocryphal gospels, or way back in history. These are depictions of Jesus' life that were rejected by the early church fathers, primarily because of how they depicted Jesus. In these apocryphal accounts, Jesus succumbs to Satan's temptation. It pictures Jesus as portrayed as making a clay sparrow and then breathing life into it and it flies away. He's pictured as dropping a dead fish into the water and making it miraculously swim away. He's depicted as turning his playmates into goats to teach them a lesson. He's also depicted as making people blind or deaf just for the thrill of healing them. The apocryphal Jesus is so bizarre. It's almost akin to a comic book hero or villain, if you like. It's so different from what the Gospels portray. You know, if you look at Jesus carefully, he showed a resistance to bend the rules on how the world works. The temptation stories actually revolve around the very questions Jesus' countrymen were wrestling with. What would the Messiah look like? Would he be the people's Messiah and turn rocks into bread? Would he be the Torah Messiah and stand tall on the pinnacle of the temple? Would he be the King Messiah and rule all over the kingdoms, or rule all the kingdoms of the world? You see, Satan is offering Jesus a chance to become the Messiah that you and I, the whole world wants. Honestly, frankly, especially today as we gather around the table, shall we not admit that we'd rather not have a suffering Messiah? And if we're honest, as Jesus prayed in the garden, neither did he. The temptation to avoid the cross surfaces again when Peter recoiled at Jesus' prediction of his own death. Peter urged Jesus to stop talking about things like that. And Jesus replied, "How? Out of my sight, Satan. You have not in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Even on the cross itself, hanging there in agony, the same temptation arises as the criminal hanging beside him scoffs Jesus, "Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us. Spectators who witnessed the crucifixion said, let him come down from the cross and we will believe him. Let God rescue him now if he wants him. But as we know, there was no rescue. There was no miracle. There was no easy, painless path. For Jesus to save others, quite simply, he could not save himself. Jesus knew that when he stood in the wilderness and faced Satan. You see, Satan in the wilderness was dangling a carrot, so to speak. He offered Jesus a way to speed up the accomplishment of his mission. He could win people over with food from stones. He could control all the kingdoms of the world, all the while protecting himself from danger. Milton put it this way out of Satan's mouth. Why move thy feet so slow to what is best? Dostoevsky, the famous Russian novelist, talks about the temptation in his powerful story, The Brothers Karamazov. In that book, he has the agnostic brother Ivan writing a poem called The Grand Inquisitor. This poem is set in 16th century Seville during the Spanish Inquisition. In the poem, Jesus visits the city of Seville and observes that heretics are being burned at the stake every day in that city. The Grand Inquisitor recognizes Jesus wandering around in the streets. He throws him in jail. The Grand Inquisitor states that Jesus should have accepted Satan's offer. Instead of taking the possession of men's freedom, you increased it, burdening the kingdom of mankind with suffering forever. In rejecting Satan's offer, Jesus made it far too easy to reject himself. He surrendered his greatest advantage to compel belief. Fortunately, the Inquisitor states, the church recognized his error and corrected it, and has been relying on miracle, mystery, and authority ever since. For this, the Inquisitor says he must execute Jesus again, lest he hinder the church's work. The temptation in the wilderness reveals in stark contrast the difference between God's power and Satan's power. Satan has the power to coerce, to dazzle, to force obedience, to destroy. And humans have been drawing inspiration from his way for centuries. You know, at the point of a gun, you can get anyone to do almost anything. God, on the other hand, has the power that works internally in a non-coercive way. People are not to be enslaved by miracles, but by faith that is freely offered. God works from the inside out, even with the inherent failings of human choice. Thomas Merton said, God's not a Nazi. The master of the universe would become its victim, powerless before soldiers in a garden. Soren Kierkegaard, famous theologian, wrote about God's light touch. Omnipotence, which can lay its hand so heavily on the world, can also make its touch so light that creatures receive an independence. I freely admit that my faith suffers from too much freedom. I get that. Too much temptation to disbelief or doubt. I admit I wish God would just come down into Simcoe, Ontario and just overwhelm me. To overcome my doubts, to provide indisputable proof of his existence, and I'm sure you all feel the same. I read the newspaper, I turn on the television, and I admit I wish God would take a more active role in human history. Couldn't he have prevented that earthquake in Turkey? Can't he stop that bloodshed in the Ukraine? And don't even get me started on those significant historical atrocities we all know about. I want God also to take a more active role in my own personal history. I want healing for my health issues, protection for my loved ones, theological arguments to persuade my unbelieving friends and neighbors. In those moments, am I not putting before God the same temptations that Satan put before Jesus? But God resists my feeble attempts to tempt him. How like the disciples I am, that I ask God to rain down fire on unrepentant cities. Instead, we should remember Jesus as he looked upon Jerusalem and said, "How often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you are not willing." I told you this before, I'm sure. My Jesus, my Messiah, will not force himself on anyone. The miracles that Satan wanted Jesus to perform are the same things I long for, but God will have none of it. God will not overwhelm us and amaze us, because God longs for you and I to love him freely. And he willingly allows people to live out their lives as if he didn't exist. He allows people to spit on his face, and he allows people to crucify him. You see, God's nature is self-giving. He is all about sacrificial love. But instead of embracing Christ's way, we discard the example, we adopt the temptations that he avoided. Uncomfortable with the slowness of the kingdom's advance in our neighborhoods and even our nations, we choose another path. And so, the church's history is littered with tragic example after tragic example of its efforts to coerce belief, or at least obedience to someone's perception of what faith looks like. And so we have that awful Inquisition, which lasts for hundreds of years. We had the city of Geneva, where John Calvin made church attendance mandatory lest you be burned at the stake for being a heretic. Then we have had churches that have joined hands with governments thinking that that's the path to greatness. And today the temptation is perpetuated by those who advocate taking the tools of politicians and advertisers to manipulate people into faith. It's not just the church. In all honesty, I too succumb to that old temptation. I look for shortcuts to meet human needs. Sometimes I feel compelled to compromise to reach a goal. Just like Jesus long ago in the wilderness, I too have the same freedom to succumb to those temptations that or resist them. To take matters into my own hands or to wait patiently on God. Perhaps we could argue that Jesus opted to sacrifice his freedom to accomplish his goals as he wished in refusing Satan's offer. But I am beginning to understand that Jesus' time in the wilderness facing Satan was yet another demonstration of his great love for you and I. You cannot make unilateral decisions that would affect the ones you love. And if Jesus had accepted Satan's offer and his challenge, he would have imposed his will on all of us, but not his love. Thomas Keller, in his book, The Reason for God, rightly points out that love demands our limiting our freedom. In every love relationship, we must sacrifice some freedom and to have greater intimacy with the one we love. For a love relationship to be truly healthy, there must be a mutual loss of independence. In a love relationship, we say to the one we love, I will adjust to you, but you must adjust to me. So did God in his infinite love adjust to you and me? Yes, he did. And in the most significant way possible. The incarnation of Jesus is the complete picture of adjusting to the one you love. In becoming human, Christ became limited. He became vulnerable and he would suffer as we do. God was saying to us through Jesus, I will, out of deep love, adjust to you and will serve you, even if it means great sacrifice. Love constrains us. And this is true of Jesus as any of us. And once we finally realize the extent of Christ's change out of love for us and gave himself for us, you should no longer be afraid to forego your own freedom and finding a new freedom in Jesus. You know, what happened in the wilderness was the first of many demonstrations to come of the cost of the incarnation on Jesus. He must have thought so as well, because maybe you've never noticed before, but he was all alone in the wilderness. So he must have been the one that told the story to the disciples. Maybe we've been thinking about this whole temptation all wrong. Sure, we have the freedom we could exercise and do whatever we want. Mind you, in doing so, we've got to be prepared to live with the consequences of exercising our freedom. But if I want a mutual relationship of love with God and Christ, then I need to be prepared to reign in my freedom. So could it be that whenever I'm tempted, the accuser, the Satan, is trying to get me to stop demonstrating my love for God, to act willfully as an independent person at the expense of my intimate relationship with God? Do you ever wonder why God in the Old Testament talks about how Israel treated him like a cheating spouse? You see, it's not about do's and don'ts, folks. It's never been about that. It's about our willingness to lay down our lives for the one who laid down his life for us. That's what Lent's about. It's a remembrance and a celebration of God's love for us in Jesus and our invitation to join in that relationship of love.